being human is a popular slogan today. But the question is, do human beings know what it means to be human? Now, the definition depends upon whom you ask. If you talk to anthropologists, if you talk to various scientists, they'll tell you that the human being is an animal, but has some differences from the other animals. So I'd like you to reflect for a few seconds upon your humanness. What do you think is special about you that distinguishes you from the animals? Is it just your peculiarities? Is it just some characteristics? Or is it your goal in life that distinguishes you from animals? If you talk to the standard scientist, he or she will explain to you, human beings are a smart, talkative ape that walks upright. And this smart, talkative ape that walks upright has attachment for lots of material possessions and territories. You see, animals, they also have attachment to possessions, birds for their nest. Animals, as you know, have family attachment also. And animals get very territorial. They take ownership over a particular tract of land, just like dogs. You walk past an area that the dog thinks he's in charge of, he barks, he growls, he may even attack you. So, both human beings and animals share those characteristics of having possessions, being attached to territory. But human beings really get big about it. And they seem to be smarter. They seem to be able to make intelligent plans. Every animal has some kind of characteristics that are peculiar to it. So if you consider the human being as an animal, then you want to discover what are the characteristics, the special characteristics of the human animal. Is there anything unique about you besides the fact that you don't walk on all fours? Let's consider, first of all, the Vedic version. As you've undoubtedly heard many times, if you've done courses here, if you've attended lectures regularly here, which I hope you have, you find out the Vedas say, Ahara Nidram Baya Maitunam Ja. Both the human beings and the animals share the activities of eating, sleeping, sex, and defense. But what the Vedas say, as you know, is that if a human being simply focuses on those four activities, that actually is not human life. No matter how complicated you make those arrangements for eating, sleeping, sex, and defense, still, these four things are the same basic animal activities. This message, Srila Prabhupada spread all over the world. Even I get messages sometimes from my university friends at Yale from 40 years ago. And they remember right after I graduated, when I discovered Srila Prabhupada's books, started reading Bhagavad Gita, I would just explain to them little snippets, just little brief items from what I was reading. This is way back in 1972. So 40 years later, my university friends they send me emails telling me, we're still the same. We're still just eating, sleeping, having sex, and defending. They remember that over 40 years. So that's due to Srila Prabhupada, who alerted the human race that you actually aren't being genuine humans, in spite of your technologically and financially complicated societies. A prominent message that you find in Srimad Bhagavatam is that economic activity is not the symptom of human intelligence. It's not the standard. Now just think, everything today is about economics, making the money. That has consumed all of the human energies. But from the Vedic point of view, such a absorption in economic affairs doesn't mean that you're a human being. So please understand that. Now, if we go from the Vedic viewpoint to the normal scientific viewpoint, unfortunately, the normal scientific viewpoint means that no one understands what is the ultimate goal of life. In fact, the ultimate goal of life is all up to you, whatever you want to make it. So from the ordinary scientific point of view, human beings have six peculiarities that distinguish them from other animals. And no, they're not going to tell you that one of those characteristics is self-realization. First of all, let's look at skill. What makes human beings special in the skill department? They are so expert at playing to the extent that they have huge complex arrangements for entertainment. Because so many other mammals, so many other advanced animals, they play, but the human being has video games and the internet and all these kinds of things. So that distinguishes the human being in the skill department. Then we look at the knowledge department, because animals show evidence of accumulating some knowledge in a very primitive way. But human beings, they accumulate scientific knowledge. That means they can make experiments, they can predict results, they can categorize, they can classify. So that's supposed to make human beings unique in the knowledge department. And then there's the behavior department. Human beings are supposed to be special because in the behavior department, human beings have parliaments, have congresses in which they make legislation, acts, laws. They vote on things, they discuss things, and then make it into a rule. Whereas animals just have behavioral instincts given by nature. What else? Feeding. Animals eat, human beings eat. But the standard understanding is that human beings don't simply eat. They make a meal. Just like when you go to our restaurant there. You don't just walk in and say, I want to eat. I would like such and such meal. I would like this kind of pizza, that kind of pizza. Yes, you've tried it? I recommend it to everyone. I had some for lunch today. So... In other words, when it comes to feeding, human beings become culinary. They get into preparing meals with spices. What animal worries about spices? No, when it's time to eat, animals just eat. So the human being distinguishes itself in that way. And then, what about the reproductive activity? Human beings are special because, unlike the animals, human beings are capable of totally divorcing that activity of reproduction from the actual purpose of reproduction. A profound use of human intelligence, huh? Besides that, though, which the Vedas condemn, ordinary scientists have come up with some other distinction for understanding the difference between human beings and animals, or the particular peculiarities of the human animal. Animals go public about whatever they do in terms of their reproductive activity, whereas human beings seek privacy. However, this distinction is fading. I know that none of you go to see Bollywood movies. Well, to speak of Hollywood movies. But if you do, and I know you don't, if you do, you'll see that the peculiarity of human beings mating in private is fading fast. Everything is public. Everything is out in the open. Even you walk around in Mumbai, Delhi, you'll see couples not simply holding hands on the street, but kissing and hugging on the street, as if doing these things in public adds some special flavor. So we've discussed 5 out of 6 supposed human peculiarities. Number 6 is in the communications department. Human beings and animals do communicate, but only, scientists say, only human beings are gossipy. Whether it's just gossiping to your neighbor next door or gossiping on Facebook, it's all the same, right? It's just gossip. So that is a peculiarity of human beings. The Srimad-Bhagavatam and Bhagavad-Gita take a much deeper approach to the question of what is a human being. A human being is defined as one who actually knows what is the ultimate goal of life, who understands that there is more than just the prayas, the temporary. There is the shreyas, the ultimate and highest goal of life. So you've heard that before. Mainly what is driving you is that you simply don't want to survive. As a human being, you want happiness. Now, what is happiness anyway? You don't see animals getting into a whole psychological confusion because they're not happy. But human beings, they really harass themselves. I'm not happy. What's going wrong? When you don't get what you want, you consider yourself not happy. And when you do get what you want, you're not happy. And you start to wonder, what is happiness anyway? As we see here in India, the traditions, especially in the cities, the traditions are breaking down. So no longer do you just mechanically do exactly what your parents say. You've got your own ideas. Of course, to a certain extent, the traditions are still there. The social pressure is still there. The conformity is still there. But you're wondering, what is going to be my special brand of happiness? What's going to be my special type of happiness? Some of you are thinking, maybe you won't find it here in India. Maybe you'll go abroad, and then you'll be free to explore. I deal with so many Indian students who have gone to Australia. And so many of them say the same thing. We came here, Well, first they tell me, Swami, we came here because we want to study. But then after they get to know me a bit better, they start to confess. We came here because we wanted to explore and in a place where none of our relatives will see what we're doing. While studying, too, of course. So the traditions that have shaped your happiness goals are crumbling now. And it may seem kind of exciting My life is in my hands. I can make my own meaning. I can make my own money. I can get my own success. I can make my own meaning. And that way, I have a chance for special happiness. So as we said before, human beings have this obsession. They're absorbed in how can they be happy. They just don't want to survive. I know sometimes life is tough in the finance department, getting a job, this and that. And sometimes you may wonder, how are you going to pay for the basics in your life? Some of you may be wondering like that. But still, in the core of your being, you want to do more than just survive. You want to feel fulfilled. You want to feel your life has meaning. You want to be happy. So what is that happiness? In the academic world, the science of happiness is a relatively new science. It's been around for maybe just under 20 years. Previously, universities would not take the study of happiness very seriously because they said, how do you quantify happiness? It's such a subjective thing. Everyone's got their own vision of what is happiness. You can't measure it. So therefore, there can't be any serious science of happiness. But in the past 15 years or so, that's all changed. Nobel Prize-winning scholars have shown that, indeed, according to certain conceptions that they have, you can measure happiness. So what they found is that most people don't even know what will make them happy. And in fact, they say, according to them, happiness is not so much a goal, but it's a process. So if you have that process of happiness, you're happy regardless of whatever goal you get. Let's try to understand that. These happiness scientists explain that it's not that success brings you happiness. Instead, it's a happy person gets success. Now think about that. They make a big deal about the difference. It's not that you get success and then you're happy. No. You have to already have the happy attitude which helps you to be successful. So what exactly is that happy attitude? In mundane material terms, it's described as a collection of positive emotions. While you are feeling good about your life. What do you think about that? Just think, you're a bundle, a collection of positive emotions for the moment, right? Of course, the kind of happiness you're feeling now is because you're in the presence of Shri Radha Gopinath, the Vaishnavas. This is Krishna's place. So here you have an atmosphere that is beyond material happiness and distress, whether you know it or not. But considering our normal material Maya consciousness, you want to feel a certain kind of buzz. And you want to feel that your life is kind of good. You want to be able to tell that to your family and friends. My life is kind of good. There are a few problems, but basically, right? Basically, I'm feeling good. I'm doing okay. I can hold my head up. Has this understanding of happiness actually helped human beings to be real human beings? The conclusion of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam is that your material happiness that you're getting and will get in this lifetime is simply a reaction to what you've done in your previous life. So much so that even if you don't endeavor for your material happiness in this lifetime, you're going to get the correct amount anyway. This is hard for people today to understand because they've been so brainwashed into thinking, life is what I make it. The harder I work, the smarter I am, the better connections that I have, the better person that I marry, the more happy I'll be. It's all up to me. I've got to make the right choices. So many of you can feel that pressure, right? You've got to make the right choices, especially in your age group. You've got so many things that are pushing on you right now. First of all, there's, as we often explain, the biological hormones. While you are thinking that you are free and independent, while you are thinking that you have so many options available to you in life, the hormones are boiling. So, scientists explain that when you're 21, when a young man is 21, he's at the peak of the male hormone cycle. That means you're a blazing fire. Just informing you what's going on. Now, from the age of 21, it's a very slow descent. Very slow. So that's one kind of pressure you're under. But the other kind of pressure you're under is, you know that if you make the wrong decision now in terms of what you study or what kind of job you get, you could be set back for 10 or 20 years, even for your whole life. The pressure is on you right now. You've got to make the right decisions. These are the formative years that you're in. You've got to throw the dice perfectly. Otherwise, you could be set back for your whole life. So the pressure's on from your family. They want to see you succeed. They want to see you get all that you can get. And you also want that. Oh, we're speaking spiritually. Excuse me, materially. I know that many of you are considering deep spiritual options, the path of bhakti. But we're speaking conventionally now. Feel that pressure upon you. I've got to be happy and be successful. From the viewpoint of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, this pressure is illusion. It's maya. But because we identify with the body and mind as a self, that means automatically we identify with all these pressures and anxieties. They're practically ripping us apart sometimes. And even what we may call happiness is a temporary agitation in our mind. Even what we call happiness is actually an agitation that makes our disease of material existence worse. This is very subtle now. I think some of you can get it, though. When you become attached to material happiness, you are actually prolonging your diseased condition. And you're actually increasing the disease condition. So then you might say, well, if I'm not going to be materially happy, what should I do with myself? That's a very important question. What are you going to do with yourself? What does a human being actually do to be human? When we look at Hanuman, the great devotee of Lord Ram, we see that he excelled in investing all his energies in the service of Lord Ram. Hanuman was not inactive. He is eternally remembered for using everything he had in the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He, even as a monkey, used his tail. As you know, he burned down the whole city of Lanka by setting fire on, by when Ravana and his cohort set fire to Hanuman's tail, he went everywhere in the city and burned the whole place down. He's showing you the supreme example of a devotee. How to use everything he's had, everything he has for the Supreme Lord's service. When we look at material life, what do we see? We also see surrender and service. Using everything you have for the illusory, temporary, insubstantial goal of material happiness. This example I often tell from Australia. One devotee, originally from Mumbai. He's in Australia for maybe 15 years. So he used to work for IBM in the IT world. So you might say, oh, he has attained the highest planet. He's gone to Indralok. He lives in Australia, and he was working for IBM. So he was describing what goes on before IBM closed its places in Australia and moved them all to India. So at the time they were still in Australia, they had about 300 employees, staff members. So they wanted to have a big, how do you say, organizational upliftment and inspiration session, just like we're having this Prayana festival. We want to all feel inspired. So similarly, in the corporate world, they also have these gatherings for inspiration for material goals. So they had a big auditorium, and they gathered their 300 staff there, and they brought in a big managemental guru from MIT in the USA. He flew all the way from the USA to Australia to inspire. Of course, he's based at MIT, but he's also Indian too. So you see what's happening. So he's addressing the big auditorium, and he's walking back and forth on the stage, and the spotlight is following him as he walks, and he's telling them what IBM is all about and what IBM expects of all its staff members. Then he would walk up the aisles in the auditorium, and the spotlight would follow him. And he went back onto the stage, and he told the crowd of 300, "I'm going to put it to you straight. There's only one kind of person who's going to keep his job in this room. We don't want anyone else. I want to know. And I'm going to walk up and down the aisles of this auditorium. The spotlight's going to follow me, and the spotlight's going to be on you. I'm going to look into your eyes and ask, when you wake up in the morning and open your eyes, is the first thing that comes into your mind your job? Those are the kind of people we want. Everyone else can go." So he did that. He's walking up and down the aisles, and the spotlight's following. He's looking, you know, in everyone's eyes. "What do you think about as soon as you wake up in the morning?" He even went up to our devotee and said like that. Of course, our devotee, he's expert. He said, "Oh, yes. As soon as I wake up, yes. I'm thinking of my work. It's the most important thing in my life." As I was explaining last night to a young men who gathered last night, you know, work is a bit of a drama, you know? It's a bit of a theater. So the Krishna devotees, they know how to act in all spheres of life. They, you know, it's not that they're dreamy and lost in the clouds, you know. They know how to deal with material affairs. I was giving another example last night. I'll repeat it. It's kind of funny. Another Indian devotee who's working in Australia. He's working for Hewlett Packard, HP. So he just told me this a few months ago. He's got a big, big CV in IT. So he can basically get any kind of job he wants. He's got years experience, top recommendations. So he just jumps from job to job, you know, whoever offers the most money at that moment. So he tells me how he handles the interviews. Because the human resources, the HR person, you know, is conducting the interview. So he figured out that they have a stereotyped idea about Indians. And he figured out how to use it for his advantage. They know that the Indians are the best IT people. They're the smartest. But he said the Australians are a bit worried that the Indians aren't team players. They don't have that camaraderie, or what they call in Australia, the mateship. They don't know how to kind of just, you know, loosen up and, you know, have a good time together with all your fellow workers. The stereotype, the preconception that they have in their minds is that you hire an Indian IT worker, he'll just stay in his cubicle. He'll have pictures of Durga and Shiva on the walls. And he'll just do his work, but he can't kind of have fun with the rest of the people on the team. You know, they're not going to drink. You know, they're not going to play with the women. They're not going to do all the normal things that human beings are supposed to do. So this devotee knows that they're thinking like that. They have that fabrication in their mind. That they think that, you know, they're taking a risk in hiring him because he won't be social enough. He won't be able to have a good time with the rest of the team. So he walks into the interview, he told me, enters the office of the interviewer, and just, "How are you doing?" And sticks out his hand. And he just jumped back like, "Ooh, what kind of Indian is this?" So he's very kind of upbeat, and he's very, you know, expressive, and the opposite of what their conceptions are, you know. So they ask him questions. Now this particular devotee, his father is a temple president in Australia. And so that means he participates in temple activities. And of course, in the Western world, ISKCON does Harinam Sankirtan chanting parties, book distribution like that on the streets. So they're asking him questions because they want to see, you know, what kind of person are we getting if we hire you? So they ask him, "When you finish working, what do you do?" He says, "What do I do when I finish working? I go out on the streets and I chant Hare Krishna." And it is, wow. And I said, "Why do you do that?" He says, "I go out on the streets and chant Hare Krishna because it helps me to relax and clear my mind so I can come back to work in the morning and be twice as fired up." And I said, "Oh." So their attitude is, "Well, whatever it takes." "Whatever it takes to motivate you to slave for the company is fine with us. Chanting Hare Krishna, scuba diving, alcohol, whatever." So yes, work life requires a bit of drama. And the bhakti knowledge will actually give you the ability to handle whatever the material world can throw at you. And indeed, that's the nature of the material world, to throw things at you. And one of the things the material world throws at you is material happiness. But not just material happiness, also the material distress. You can't have one without the other, because it's a world of dualities. So if you're smart enough to figure this out, You save yourself so much trouble. And that's what the life of the Krishna Bhakta is all about. Saving yourself so much trouble. Avoiding pursuing goals that are illusion. So just think. No matter how hard you try to be materially happy, you're not going to get more than what you're destined to get due to your past life activities. Now, we may have explained this before in previous Purana festivals. Often I get the question that, look, don't we have a lot of choice? Let's say that I want to be happy with a particular person. So, to me, it's obvious that if I choose Mary instead of Jane, I'll be happier. So isn't that showing that I've got the power to shape my life? It seems like it, doesn't it? Mary looks better. She can give me more material enjoyment than Jane. Mm-hmm. If I choose Mary, I'm showing my independence. I'm showing the ability to shape my life and to shape my happiness. But what does the Shastra explain? It explains that whether you choose Mary or Jane, you're going to get the same amount of material happiness that you do from your past life. So you can save yourself so much trouble by understanding that, by not thinking that you are so much the shaper of your current material affairs. You can change your material circumstances, but you can't change the amount of happiness that you do. Just like, okay, you broke your arm, it's distressful. You go to the doctor, and he fixes your broken arm. You might say, I have adjusted my distress. But no. Any distress that you're due, if it doesn't come through the broken arm, if you stop it by coming through the broken arm, it comes another way. Any happiness that you're due, if you don't get it through Mary, you'll get it through someone else. But you can't change that stock amount. But you think by adjusting the circumstances, changing persons, changing cars, changing jobs, changing this, that, you're changing your happiness. No. You're going to get what you're going to get no matter what. So if you understand this, you can save yourself so much trouble. That's the Shastra version. Let's look at the mundane version. The Maya version is that there's a percentage. Your happiness is composed of 50% genetics. So 50% of how happy you're going to be is determined by your genes. And 10% of your happiness is determined by circumstances, and 40% is determined by your own endeavors. So that's the cutting edge material understanding of happiness. 50% is, man, it depends on your genetic hardware. You can't adjust that. 10% your circumstances. Many times you can adjust your circumstances. In a traditional society, which is, even India as a traditional society is changing so much. In a traditional society, you're handed or you enter into circumstances that are very difficult to change. It used to be very difficult to change your job or change your wife or change this or change that. Now these days, everything you can just throw out the window, right? Wife, children, out the window. That's advancement. That's human civilization. You might think that maybe I'm just speaking very strongly because that's the nature of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. And when we come to Radha Gopinath Mandir, we should hear Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. But then when we go out the door, then we deal with the real world. So let me give you some insight into what's going on in the so-called real world, which is actually the illusory world. Recently, survey was done in the USA by the government on young people. And it found that almost 50% of all the young people in the country have at least one psychiatric disorder. At least 50%. 45% of university students, 47% of those who have not gone to university. So obviously knowledge is not making much of a difference. Almost half of the young people are suffering some disorder that requires psychiatric treatment. Then I was just reading some statistics from the UK. The Department of Education in the UK did a survey, questioned parents, and found that 40% of all parents report that their child has experienced pornography on the internet. 40%. So you might think the internet is bringing such convenience and ready information to everyone, but look at the huge damage that it's doing. It's showing you that when you have human beings in animal consciousness, they may make the greatest technology, but they're going to use it to destroy themselves. 4 out of 10, 40%. Of parents reported their child, not teenager, child has experienced pornography on the internet. And the government did a further analysis and found that 30% of parents are reporting that their children have received abominable emails. 30%. So you begin to wonder. The technology's advanced, but human beings themselves are so primitive and they're going backwards. They have no idea of mind and sense control. They're destroying themselves. They're destroying their children, destroying their families. So those are just two sets of statistics that give you insight into what's going on. And therefore, you would want to take Krishna's instructions in Bhagavad Gita very seriously. So generally, in a traditional society, your circumstances, which mundane scientists consider to be 10% of the total picture of happiness, generally you can't change those circumstances. Although now, as I said, everything is up in the air. So here is the catch, that by your changing your circumstances, by using your 40%, the way they say it, your 40% of choice and independence, by using your 40% choice independence to change your circumstances, unless you know how to act to sustain your happiness, whatever changes you make, the so-called happiness fades very quickly. So even material scientists are acknowledging that. Okay, let's say, in using Western terms, this is how they talk. You're locked into a terrible marriage. So what do you do? It's obvious what you do. You escape that terrible marriage and you find at least one other person. Why not more? And in that way, you've increased your happiness. But these material scientists will tell you that the bump that you get, the rise, the lift that you get by changing your circumstances and experiencing so-called happiness, that lift, that rise, very soon fades because you become accustomed to it. It's called adaptation. It's a psychological term, adaptation. Or let's say you get tired of your old car. You buy a Mercedes, a BMW, you feel so good, but it can't last. So it seems that with your intelligence, you've changed your circumstances. But because of this psychological thing called adaptation, very soon the buzz, the bang fades. And these material scientists admit the reason why it fades is because you don't know any internal techniques for sustaining that happy feeling. You don't have those kind of skills. And they acknowledge that they don't have those skills either. So there you have your material situation. 50% genetics. It could be that your genes are not disposed to make you a happy person. So that's 50% of your suffering. 10% circumstances. 40% depends on your endeavors. Now just think. If you're not the material body, if you're not the material mind, then your endeavors for happiness are on a completely different level. And that's Krishna's approach in Bhagavad Gita. Real human life means how to invest even your temporary body and mind in Krishna's service. This is the example that Hanuman set. Rather than investing your temporary body and mind in the service of illusion. So you have to analyze your life in this way. And this investment in bhakti is beyond genetics. It's beyond circumstances. It's beyond your material endeavors. This is the super excellence of the bhakti lifestyle. Nowhere in Bhagavad Gita does Krishna say, well, you know, 50% depends on your genetics. Ten percent of your circumstances. The analysis is not there in Bhagavad Gita. Everywhere in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, your genuine happiness, the revival of your original Krishna consciousness, depends on your engaging in devotional service. Bhakti, Krishna consciousness, is 100% about devotional activity. That's the example that Hanuman set. With great enthusiasm, with great intelligence, with great determination, he served Lord Ram. He shows how exciting bhakti is. He shows how spirited it is, how it's full of the greatest energy, the greatest dedication. Would you say to Hanuman, using the framework or the mindset of a mundane psychologist today, would you say, Hanuman Prabhu, are you feeling a combination of positive emotions? Hanuman Prabhu, do you feel that your life is good? Those questions all seem so ridiculous when you're dealing with Hanuman. Because such questions have missed the point of devotional dynamics. The investing in the devotional service of the Lord. That is beyond material happiness. It's beyond material distress. It's beyond genetics. It's beyond circumstances. This is the unique bhakti advantage. So we're not interested in just being human. In fact, we will tell people that human life begins with the four regular principles. No intoxication, no meat eating, no gambling, no illicit sex. Those things, I don't have to explain to you, but often in the West, I have to explain. Because people, when they hear those four rules, they think, oh my God. that must make you a saint to follow those four rules. And I have to explain that following those four rules simply makes you a human being. Following the four rules doesn't exactly make you transcendental. It clears out the debris, the garbage, so that the chanting of Hare Krishna can make you transcendental. So we stress the two things together. What Srila Prabhupada's mission is doing is something that's hasn't been done before, at least in modern times. Making human beings at the same time making transcendentalists. It's all going on at once. It's inconceivable how it's happening. Taking artificial, fake, phony human beings and making them into real human beings and at the same time making them transcendental. It's a huge undertaking. It's the most exciting mission, the most exciting activity. It's the best career. It's the best job. So, you may not be able to become a full-time staff member in such an enterprise. But you can be a supporter. Every enterprise needs supporters. And the amazing thing about your being a supporter is that you share in the benefits that the staff members get. You get a chance to please Krishna simply by supporting Krishna's staff workers. And who knows, some of you might even become a staff member. So this is how broad bhakti is. The staff gets Krishna. The supporters of the staff get Krishna. Everyone gets to go to the supreme destination. So indeed, this is the best thing to do with your human form of life. And we do add one reminder. It's a solemn reminder that just like you have the human form of life now, you can also lose it. And that is the greatest disaster. That's why Krishna warns in Bhagavad Gita, Swapamapyasya Dharmasya Trayate Mahatobhya. Just a little bit of advancement in bhakti will save you from the greatest fear. What's the greatest fear? Not that you're going to lose your job, you're going to lose your money, lose your health. The greatest fear is that you'll lose this human form of life. So the intelligent human being is thinking, what kind of body will I get next? And age of Kali culture, what does it tell you? Who cares? Next life? I don't see any next life, do you? I was walking in a city in New Zealand, and I went past a beauty shop where both men and women go for, you know, hairstyling and nails and all that kind of thing. So they had a sign outside the beauty shop. And the sign said, one life is all you get, but if you do it right, one life is all you need. You might wonder about the secret meaning of that. Do I have to explain? One life is all you get. In other words, there's no next life. But even though you only get one life, if you have good sense gratification, one life is all you need. We don't consider this mentality to be human. I'm sorry, but that's the way it is. We don't consider such an attitude to be human. A human being is one who is progressive, who understands the spiritual values of life, who is concerned with what is my next destination. Age of Kali culture means, what is your concern? What will be your next job? What will be your next girlfriend? So we reject that kind of so-called human society. Let us meditate on the example of Hanuman, the full investment example. That's the standard Hanuman says. How to use all the energies, everything you have, in the service of the Supreme. So I ask you to think deeply about these points. You're at a critical time in your life. You can make a big difference based on your decisions now. Think very carefully. Take advantage of all facilities for spiritual guidance as you navigate these very special years. And that way you can handle the pressure because you'll have knowledge, because you're participating in a culture of inspiration and guidance. That's what these festivals are all about, a culture of inspiration and guidance, so that you can actually pass over all the obstacles of material life and make spiritual advancement while you're passing over the obstacles. So you don't want to become derailed by material distress or material happiness. You want something higher. The human form of life is meant to go beyond happiness and distress and achieve engagement in devotional service to Krishna. You can do that, as we said, as a staff member. You can do that as a supporter. Any service that you do for the Supreme Personality of Godhead will be your eternal asset, your eternal credit. So bhakti is for the shrewdest persons, the smartest persons, the most intelligent persons. That's the kind of human being that we want to be. And those are the kind of human beings that we want to associate with. So we're not interested in just being human as ordinarily thought of. In fact, we disagree with that standard of humanity. We don't even call it humanness. The great message of Srila Prabhupada's mission, representing the line of acharyas, is that real human life begins with understanding you're different from your body and mind, and that the goal of your life is how to reconnect with Krishna. That is the way to find true happiness beyond the comings and goings of temporary happiness and distress. Thank you, Hare Krishna.